From the Sonoran Desert to the Kootenai National Forest, this is Go West Young Podcast, your show about America's parks and public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver. On the show this week, Election Day has come and gone, so it's time to start counting down to Election Day. We will take a deep dive into what Western voters want when it comes to American lands in 2020. Plus, a species that was thought to be extinct brought back from the brink. The rediscovery of the black-footed ferret this week in Western history. But first, a little news. The U.S. House passed a series of public lands bills, including the CORE Act, which we talked about here on this podcast a few months ago with one of its sponsors, Congressman Joe Neguse. That's the bill that would protect more than 400,000 acres of public land in Colorado. It's the result of a decade of discussions across the state, but the bill faces an uncertain future in the Senate. Senator Cory Gardner is still not on board, saying he wants to see more room for grazing, and he wants to remove wilderness protections from some areas that aren't even included in the bill right now. Colorado's other senator, Michael Bennett, is pushing for a hearing in the Senate, but it is not clear if Lisa Murkowski, the chair of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, will grant that hearing, much less a vote. Two other bills that we have talked about a lot here also made it out of the House. The Chaco Cultural Heritage Area Protection Act would limit oil and gas drilling within a 10-mile buffer around Mexico's Chaco Culture National Historical Park, and the Grand Canyon Centennial Protection Act would make permanent a ban on new uranium mining claims across the greater Grand Canyon watershed. Those bills face the same uncertain future in the Senate, where it is not clear if Murkowski or Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would even let them come up for a vote, despite the fact that, as you are about to hear, Western voters across the political spectrum say they want candidates who will protect sensitive public lands like Chaco and the Grand Canyon from fracking, drilling, and mining. This week marks Election Day 2019, which means we are now 1 year away from the national election of 2020. Obviously, the presidential race is going to consume a whole lot of attention over the next 52 weeks, but all of the U.S. House and a third of the Senate are also up for grabs. And so for the third election cycle in a row, the Center for Western Priorities has gone into the field with public opinion polling to find out how conservation and public lands issues drive voters in Western states. We call it Winning the West, and I am joined today by pollster Brian Gottlieb of Gottlieb Strategic Research.
Hi.
Also, our executive director here at the Center for Western Priorities, Jennifer Rocola.
Hello.
Welcome back to both of you. Obviously, this poll has a whole lot more information in it than we have time to get to in just one episode. There are links to the poll in the show notes. Let me start by asking both of you, though, if there is one single takeaway you think candidates should understand from this poll, what is it? And I'll start with Jen on that one.
Well, Aaron, I think whether you're a Democrat running for office in the West or a Republican running for office in the West, public lands and conservation issues have broad bipartisan support from voters in the West. And big majorities across the states where we polled, voters believe that we should be protecting more land and parks as national parks and national monuments.
Brian, your one takeaway?
Yeah, I want to echo what Jen just said. Really, these public lands issues that we see year after year, they are becoming more and more, as I see it, nonpartisan as the electorate seems to be, or politicians seem to be becoming more partisan. So there's just so much agreement on so many of these issues. I guess that's the biggest takeaway I have.
So there are obviously, well, you mentioned broad agreements, but there are also some different lessons depending on the party for certain candidates, certainly even maybe some warnings in terms of how to talk about public lands, both with their base and also with swing voters. Brian, what do you were some of the key warnings or differences that Republican or Democratic candidates should be aware of?
Well, I think the warning is the same for both, and it's really to try not to become too extreme on either side. So, you know, on the left, and I'm going to probably be using this example a few times today, but on, you know, we have on one side of the scale, keep it in the ground, and on the other side of the scale, drill, baby, drill. And, you know, to me, the answer really is somewhere in the middle. And so understanding that you need to go further to the left in primary or further to the right in a primary, depending on your party, don't go too far because it's very hard to get to the middle. And that's really where the middle, the balance, where the bulk of the voters are that agree on these public lands issues and feel passionately about them.
Jen, do you think that's right? Is there a risk that candidates could box themselves in a primary?
Oh, absolutely. Looking at the Democratic primary, the keep it in the ground faction of the Democratic Party, I think, puts a candidate at risk of going too far on a policy that voters in the West want regulation and they want limits, but they don't support, banning all energy development.
So let's go through a couple key takeaways from the state-by-state questions, and then we will come back to what this means overall in terms of the Trump administration's policies. First off, uranium mining near the Grand Canyon is in the news. A bill that would make that mineral withdrawal permanent passed the House last week. Brian, where are Arizona voters when it comes to uranium?
Well, 59% oppose drilling near the Grand Canyon. Drilling or mining near the Grand Canyon, 29%, only 29% support, and the rest are undecided.
So a 30% gap.
Absolutely, it's 2-1. And then looking at the parties, 77% of Democrats oppose that kind of drilling and mining. So that's just overwhelming there. And Republicans are split. So it's just, to me, it's not really a partisan issue, it's just not popular in Arizona.
Well, and Aaron, I would add that even though this is obviously an Arizona-specific issue, it's an issue that all candidates running for federal office need to pay attention to because there is legislation. And as you mentioned, the bill passed the House last week, and we should see it in the Senate at some point.
We were in Montana a couple weeks ago, taping a live episode. We heard a lot in that episode about how Montana is different from the rest of the West when it comes to public lands, or at least the visibility and awareness of public lands in politics, especially when it comes to access to lands. Do the numbers that we saw here back up what we heard anecdotally when we were in Montana, Brian?
Yeah, I think so. But that's not really surprising to me. If you look at the crosstabs, you'll see that 44% of voters in Montana are anglers and 30% are hunters. That compares to 23%, so a quarter of the sample being anglers and only 9% being hunters. So many more voters in Montana are actively participating on public lands in terms of fishing and hunting than in the other Western states. So they're going to feel very passionate about these access issues. And we see that on a number of questions where we ask them about, how concerned they are about diminishing the public's access to public lands. And they score higher than other states on questions like that. So it definitely, the data definitely backs up what you saw anecdotally.
Jen, you were in Montana with us a couple weeks ago. From what you heard there and what you see in these numbers, how do you now understand Montana as being somewhat different from other Western states in that, is it the oil, or is it the hunting and the fishermen that make Montana slightly different than other states?
Yeah, I think that's true, Aaron, and I think we've seen it play out in various elections. When you look at the 2016 race between Governor Bullock and Greg Gianforte, it was about access to public lands. And I think Gianforte learned a hard lesson in that election, in that his support for access to public lands wasn't where Montanans were. And then you saw that in the last election cycle between in Senator Tester's race against Matt Rosendale. Matt Rosendale just didn't have the, hold the standard that Montanans expect from a from their U.S. senator.
Let's talk about New Mexico. We, over the last couple of weeks, have been fortunate enough to talk to one senator, two members of Congress, and the state lands commissioner. So we have asked them all variations on this question of New Mexico being the home of America's biggest public lands oil and gas drilling boom right now in the Permian Basin. And all four of those elected officials talked about the need to transition New Mexico's economy. Are voters in the same place, or are New Mexico voters just bought in, hey, this is where our state's economy is right now, Brian?
Well, just as we've seen in the other states, New Mexico, it really isn't very different. You know, when asked if they agree or disagree with a proposal to increase development in renewables like wind and solar, 81% agree with that proposal, would support that proposal, and only 13% disagree. So, you know, New Mexico voters are definitely interested in diversifying and looking for balance. Another question that sort of piqued my interest is, you know, when asked if they agree or disagree that public land should be used for a balance of preservation, recreation, and energy development, 68% of New Mexico voters agree with that, and only a quarter disagree. So again, we're, just like in the other states, we see that voters in New Mexico are looking for balance.
Huge, huge gaps then. It's not like these are numbers that you're seeing a strong partisan debate. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
So when you look at these individual policy numbers, both in the individual states and across the West, Jen, is there a takeaway in terms of the current administration's policies and how those could end up playing out as a campaign issue?
Absolutely. I mean, when we look at the poll, it looks like this administration is on the wrong side of where voters in the West are, whether it's the protection for the sage-grouse habitat, drilling near national parks and national monuments, unprotecting national monuments like Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. Voters in the West want those protections, and this administration has done everything in their power to unwind these protections. So at this point, they are on the wrong side of history.
Brian, do you think that's an accurate assessment, and does this create landmines then for Republican candidates potentially in the West over the next year?
Well, yeah, I absolutely agree with Jen. And, you know, going back to one of my earlier comments, the administration on these public lands issues seems to be moving more and playing more to, you know, what they see as the base, and taking more extreme positions rather than trying to attract a larger base of voters that are more in that middle section that would agree on so many more proposals than what they have. So they could still act on public lands, and in my opinion, act on public lands issues in a conservative and Republican way and still get 75% of the voters as opposed to alienating a majority of them.
I want to take a step back. We hear a lot about how healthcare becomes a top issue in the election. We hear a lot about the economy being at the top of voters' concerns. How does conservation, public lands, environmental issues stack up relative to what we tend to hear in the media as being voters' top issues?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, and it's a question that we get every year. You know, if you were to rank the issues, public lands would certainly come out below a number of other issues in terms of priority that way. But the way that we ask the question is whether or not these issues are important to them, or how concerned they are about these issues. When you do that individually, you can really see the strength of the issue. And the reason why that's important is because on any given issue, when a voter thinks that, or public lands in particular, when a voter sees that they're threatened, they're more likely to act and vote based on that issue. And so if an issue scores high within its own question of importance, that they're much more likely to act than if it doesn't, you know, score well in terms of importance at all. So the issue of public lands, waters, and wildlife, when we ask them if it was important or not, 78% say that it is important, and 39% say it's very important. So the intensity there, the passion behind that answer is very strong. Only 20% of voters in the West say that public lands are not important. So if this were to become a campaign issue, it's certainly an issue that voters would stand up and listen to. Now, comparing that to other issues and how they scored, it's public lands issues are very similar, actually a little stronger than the climate change issue in terms of its scores. So climate change came in at 71% important to 27% not important. So very similar to climate change, which is an issue we hear about all the time in the media.
Well, and Brian, I was also struck by the bipartisan support for or the importance of public lands. I mean, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or an unaffiliated voter, that ranked high within partisan scores as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, and Republicans and Democrats maybe are coming at public lands and the reason for their importance from different angles. So Republicans may be coming at it from more of a hunting and angling perspective, and the Democrats may be coming from it from more of a preservation or conservation perspective. Although the conservation issue word itself certainly transcends party, but overall the issue is very, very bipartisan.
Well, and I think that may come back to the open-ended questions that we asked at the beginning. When you ask Western voters what do they like about living in the West, the answers almost across the board go to the outdoors. And it becomes an identity issue in the West, I think, in a way that, say, climate may not be nationwide because it's not as core to the identity of why people live here.
Absolutely. I mean, the open-ended question over and over again, we saw all kinds of things related to the outdoors, you know, whether it's mountains and open spaces and, you know, and lands and all of that. But then when you ask the close-ended question, do you strongly agree or, you know, agree or disagree with the statement that the mountains and outdoors are what make living in your state special? Overall, 93% of the samples, so 93% of Western voters agree with that, and only 5% disagree. The outdoors and public lands are the reason why people live there.
I want to dive back into this notion of balance, which is something both of you mentioned as a key takeaway. Give us some examples of where the line is on either side that could put candidates at risk, especially when it comes to say, oil and gas drilling.
Well, I think I said this a little bit earlier. I think the line lies somewhere between keep it in the ground and drill, baby, drill. Voters want to see a balance between energy development, recreation, and conservation. So in terms of what does this mean, it means balancing between oil and gas development and renewables. So you have a little bit of each, and you don't close off. You don't say we're only going to do renewables and not do any oil and gas. And you don't say we're only going to drill for oil and gas and not try to explore for or develop renewable energy. And then, you know, the balance also exists between preservation and access, you know, and access for recreation and hunting and so on. So basically, you know, we need to make sure that we're preserving and protecting this land for future generations. But we also need to make sure that that there's enough access there for people to enjoy them and use them today. That's why they live there.
One of the more interesting questions that caught my eye here was a very subtle language difference where when you ask folks if they support prohibiting or ask them if they support limiting oil and gas drilling? How big a difference does just that one subtle word change make, Brian?
That's a very good question, and we actually split sampled some specific language on this. We asked voters whether they support or oppose prohibiting all oil and gas and coal extraction on public lands versus limiting oil and gas and coal extraction on public lands. And the way we did this is that half the sample got, so half of voters, people that were in the survey, got the prohibit language, and the other half got the limit language. The prohibit language for overall got 48% support to 44% oppose. So basically not really strong at all. That's split. The limit language, on the other hand, got 67% support to 23% oppose. So makes a huge difference in terms of the kind of language that you use, and really is a great example of what I was talking about in terms of using the language of the extreme, which is prohibit, versus using the language of balance and moderation, which is limit.
So changing one word takes you from basically a split down the middle issue to a 3-1 winner, essentially.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, words matter. And that's why we do research, and that's why campaigns do research. There are people, you know, if words didn't matter, there wouldn't be a reason for message testing or anything like that. Absolutely. Just the difference between keeping in the ground, prohibiting, and limiting is a big, big difference.
Well, and Brian, when you look at the partisan breakdown of that as well, I mean, you've got even Democrats supporting limiting by 10 points more than they supported prohibiting.
Right. So that also backs up the case there, where you're not losing on the Democratic side. You're not losing your base by going more toward that balanced approach of limiting. They think that they need to go way out to the extreme in order to attract voters by saying prohibit and keep it in the ground. But the reality is that limit actually performs better.
Jen, there are some specific policy proposals in here that Congress could get to this session. Presumably, members who are running for re-election could even campaign on them next year. I'm thinking, obviously, fully funding the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which is in play. What else is in here that folks should be looking at in terms of legislation to either campaign on or try to pass?
Well, I think conservation funding overall draws wide bipartisan support. Obviously, the Land and Water Conservation Fund, fully funding it at the $900 million level without having to go through the appropriations process every year, has great bipartisan support. But also, voters want to see increased funding for national parks, monuments, and wildlife refuges. They would support increased funding to build new trails and campgrounds, and they want to increase royalties that companies pay for energy development on public lands, and they want to reinvest those royalties back into public lands. So I think there's broad bipartisan support for more comprehensive conservation funding.
Brian, let me wrap up by asking both of you, what surprised you the most when you got these results back?
So to me, what surprised me the most is that there's just so much overwhelming bipartisan or nonpartisan agreement on key proposals like the ones that Jen just mentioned. There are 6 or 7 proposals that are just completely bipartisan that we tested. Jen just mentioned, I think, about 4 or 5 of them. Yet the parties themselves and the candidates themselves seem to be moving away from the voters and sort of the balanced approach that we're talking about here and more towards the extremes. So, one side seems to be looking at the keep it in the ground message, and the other side is more about, you know, energy independence. But really, what that really means to a lot is, that drill, baby, drill message that we heard a few election cycles ago. So that's what really surprises me, because to me, as a consultant, I see gold here, really, in those five or six proposals that that would attract so many voters in the West. And yet, for some reason, the candidates seem to be moving in other directions.
Sounds like there's a conservation middle that's very much up for grabs. Jen, would you agree with that?
I do agree with that, and I'm really encouraged by the results of this poll. We've seen it in the last two election cycles that conservation and public lands have played a bigger role in these campaigns, and these results tell me that they are going to play an even greater role in the 2020 election from the state and local level all the way to the federal level.
All right. Jen's the big boss, so she gets the last word today. Jennifer Rocola is the executive director here at the Center for Western Priorities. Brian Gottlieb is a pollster with Gottlieb Strategic Research. He conducted our Winning the West 2020 poll, which you can find in the show notes and at winningthewest2020.org. Brian, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And Jen, thank you for coming back.
Thank you.
We like to wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. So let's head up to the small town of Meteetse, Wyoming, population 368 back in 1981. That September, Lucille Hogg was on her ranch when her dog Shep came back home carrying a dead black-footed ferret. That was remarkable because the last known wild black-footed ferret had died in 1979. Attempts at captive breeding had failed. The species was thought to be extinct. Now, remember, the Endangered Species Act was less than a decade old. It had passed in 1973. The Fish and Wildlife Service had approved a recovery plan for the black-footed ferret in 1978, but that was too little too late. So, when Shep the dog turned up with a ferret, biologists and wildlife officials descended on Little Meteetse, Wyoming. And on November 6th, 1981, the Fish and Wildlife Service announced they had successfully captured a black-footed ferret and outfitted it with a radio collar so biologists could track its movements and hopefully find more. They did find 129 of them within a few years, all in that same area, but the population started to crash after 1984. Within a few years, it was clear this tiny population of ferrets in Wyoming were the only ones left. In 1987, Fish and Wildlife started another captive breeding program, rounding up all 18 of the last known living black-footed ferrets in a final attempt to save the species. It was, at the time, the rarest mammal on Earth. And this time, it worked. It was one of the first times that assisted reproduction, including artificial insemination and in vitro fertilization, was used to bring a species back from the brink. Two litters were born in captivity that first year, and for the first time, they lived. Zoos across the country started joining the captive breeding program. Within 2 years, there were 120 black-footed ferrets, all of them still, of course, in captivity. And then in 1991, 4 years after the ferrets were gone from the wild, 49 of them were reintroduced in Wyoming. The next year, those ferrets started reproducing in the wild. And today, black-footed ferrets are being reintroduced in Mexico, Canada, and across the American West. There are about 350 black-footed ferrets in the wild today, all of them descended from those last 18 ferrets discovered by a ranch dog in Meteetse, Wyoming, 38 years ago this week in Western history. And that is it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. Thanks again to Brian Gottlieb for his polling expertise. You can find all of the results from our Winning the West survey at winningthewest2020.org. I will mention that if you work with campaigns or candidates from any party, we are happy to give more detailed Winning the West briefings. Just reach out and ask. As a numbers guy, I really enjoy getting to dive deep with folks, even with more time than we had here on this podcast this week. We, of course, love to get your feedback and ideas for future episodes. Send your email to podcast@westernpriorities.org or drop me a line on Twitter. I am A. Weiss there. And I would be forever grateful if you left us a rating on Apple Podcasts or just shared this episode with a friend. My name is Aaron Weiss. On behalf of Jen Rocola and the entire team here at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks for listening.